Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Wednesday, April 30th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Fox media critic Howard Kurtz takes a shot at his own network for how it covered, or didn't cover, the Cliven Bundy story. The Chicago Tribune publishes emails that show producers of the CNN docuseries Chicagoland gave Mayor Rahm Emanuel's office some control over storylines. And we've got a fun look back 20 years ago to when NPR first ventured into the Wild West, known as the World Wide Web. There's a lot more, hopefully, we'll get to as well, but let's start with what's pretty much become a basketball death sentence for Clippers owner Donald Sterling. Commissioner Adam Silver banned Sterling from the game for life and fined him $2.5 million for making racist comments. TMZ ran a recording of Sterling telling a girlfriend not to bring black people to games.
I don't want you to hate. That's what people do. They turn things around. I want you to love them privately. In your whole life, every day you could be with them, every single day of your life.
But not in public?
But why publicize it on the Instagram and why bring it to my games?
Why bring the black people to the game?
I really don't want to discuss that anymore. It's over. I don't want to talk about it.
I'm sorry that you feel that way.
I feel that way so strongly, and it may cause our relationship to just break apart. And if it does, it does. It's better to break apart now than to break apart later.
I'm sorry that you still have people around you that are full of racism and hate in their hearts. I'm sorry that you're still racist in your heart. I'm sorry that you live in a world that still...
How about your whole life? Every day, you could do whatever you want. You could sleep with them, you could bring them in, you could do whatever you want. The little I ask you is not to promote it on that and not to bring them to my games.
The picture that triggered that rant shows V. Steviano standing to the right of basketball legend Magic Johnson. To their left is Steviano's friend, Rachel Rodriguez. TMZ broke the story on Friday, and by the middle of the day on Tuesday, Sterling has been banned from basketball for life. The speed of the story, maybe not so surprising, is who broke it.
Well, TMZ is the National Enquirer of this generation. I mean, I remember back when the whole O.J. Simpson thing was going. If you really wanted to keep up with what was going on with O.J. Simpson, you read the National Enquirer, even the national media. The mainstream media was following the National Enquirer. Same thing here. TMZ breaks the story. It's got the publicity going. Everyone's following them. So, I mean, I think it's another one of those things about the environment of Los Angeles, the environment of Hollywood, in which you can have an upstart sort of media organization that can actually do this.
I mean, in Hollywood, they are the brand in terms of uncovering this kind of celebrity news, and they've done it many, many times before. I mean, they did it with Mel Gibson and his anti-Semitic rant. I mean, they did it with Alec Baldwin calling his daughter names. I mean, you know, this is their territory. And the only thing I'd say is that we should remember TMZ isn't this little boutique, you know, or they're not even a separate company like, you know, the National Enquirer. Mm-hmm. They are owned by Time Warner, which owns HBO, CNN, Time Magazine, a lot of other reputable media outlets. And in some ways, they're becoming pretty reputable, too, at least when it comes to covering these kinds of stories.
And I think the good thing about what's happening here in terms of recognition is that I remember back in the earlier days with the National Enquirer and others, they weren't getting the recognition right away that TMZ is. They weren't given the credit. So I think that the media has come a long way in terms of this is the organization that broke the story. We're going to give them credit. Now, that being said, I would think that since it all broke out, I think ESPN has probably been in the forefront in covering what's been going on. And I think that they've done a pretty good job in spite of the fact that oftentimes because you have that contract of, in this case, the National mm-hmm. Basketball Association, it can have a damper on how you cover it. But I think that they've done a pretty good job.
How much of that, though, has also been because the league has been so quick to condemn Sterling's comments and other owners and the Players Association?
I think that had a lot to do with it. The fact that the players themselves, they went out and they developed their own voice. They brought in Kevin Johnson, who's a Hall of Fame, soon-to-be Hall of mm-hmm. Fame NBA player, who's now the mayor of Sacramento, to be their spokesperson, to basically say, here's what we want from the league. And they put that out there to the NBA, to the media, in particular to ESPN, so that they could get their message out. And I think that the players themselves pushed this to the point where they actually had to act very quickly.
I mean, I think TMZ and the media in general did a good job, and they certainly elevated this story to the kind of, you know, blowout where everybody's talking about it. But I think the real reason is, you asked why did it happen so quickly, it was all about the money. I mean, there were advertisers that were pulling out of, you know, of sponsoring the Clippers, and some big ones, you know. I mean, we're talking about State Farm Insurance, which advertised on a lot of sports broadcasts around the country. They were pulling out, and others were too. And then you had the threat of the players, and I think they really made it serious. There was a report last night during the game with the Clippers and the Warriors where they said just prior to the game, The players were ready to boycott that game, mm-hmm. but they also had star players on other teams that were in playoff games yesterday that were threatening to boycott if the NBA didn't take the action that it
and
did.
And that in and of itself, that's money, because if you actually think about it, you had these games being broadcast nationwide, and the players would just basically walk off the court at the beginning of the game and refuse to play. I mean, I don't think the networks, not ESPN, TNT, or ABC would be able to deal with that kind of a ramification.
Yeah.
A few months ago, we had also talked a lot, especially when it was around the time of debate sparking again about the Redskins and the team name and the racist implications there, that Bob Costas had come out during an NFL broadcast and spoke against that. Well, he did that again this week on MSNBC, telling Andrea Mitchell that the media can and should be playing a role in moving this forward and putting pressure on Sterling to force him out of ownership as well. Do you agree with that?
I don't know if I agree that the media should be looking for a specific outcome, but I mean, this is a story that needs to be told, and it's an opportunity to tell a bigger story. And I think the media have been pretty responsible in doing that. Some people would say it is the responsibility of the media to look for certain outcomes. I'm not sure I'd go that far. Nonetheless, the result of the coverage, assuming, you know, that Sterling doesn't sue and doesn't drag this out for a long time, the result's going to be the same.
Yeah, I think the media has done a pretty good job. I think they took their cue from President Obama when he said, you know, when someone of this kind of ignorance speaks, you just let them go ahead and do it and you just put it out there for everyone to see. Yeah. I think that's basically what the media did in this instance. And I think you've seen the results of that.
Yeah. OK, well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just one last thing. I say one couple of media issues that we need to think about in terms of whether there's going to be a lawsuit or whether TMZ behaved mm-hmm. appropriately or not. Did they pay for the tape? We don't know that yet. And they certainly haven't. They never admit that they pay for anything. But the other thing is, in California, unlike some states like Missouri, it's a two-party consent state when it comes to recording audio or video. And so it's quite possible, I mean, that maybe it's a slender reed, but Donald Sterling could certainly sue from the standpoint this whole thing came from a tape that was, quote, illegally distributed.
Made in private.
Right. But that's going to happen in a court of law.
Yeah.
And in the NBA court, which is basically bound by the NBA Constitution, they have, at least according to legal experts, the NBA is doing exactly what they can do under their own constitution.
Right.
Okay. So our next story is about more racist remarks, unfortunately. A month ago, Cliven Bundy was a little-known Nevada cattle rancher fighting the federal government over grazing fees. He became a conservative folk hero of sorts, and supporters filled his farm 80 miles outside of Las Vegas, protesting the seizure of 900 head of his cattle. The protest escalated, resulting in a standoff between an armed militia and the Bureau of Land Management. Senator Rand Paul and Dean Heller backed Bundy until a story in the New York Times that ran these comments.
I want to tell you one more thing I know about the Negro. The older people and the kids, and there's always at least a half a dozen people sitting on the porch. They didn't have nothing to do. They didn't have nothing for their kids to do. They didn't have nothing for their young girls to do. And because they were basically on government subsidy, and so now what do? They abort their young children. They put their young men in jail because they never learned how to pick cotton. And I've often wondered, now, are they better off as slaves picking cotton, having family life and doing things, or are they better off under government subsidy?
After the New York Times ran its story, other local and national media jumped on board. It was the Washington Post that first got its hands on that recording that we had just heard. There was one news agency, though, that was noticeably quiet on the subject. Here's Howard Kurtz on Fox's Media Buzz.
In my view, Fox News fell seriously short on this story on Thursday, all day long until special report at 6 p.m. Eastern. There was virtually no mention of these racist remarks by Clive Bundy when everybody else was covering it. And I think that to ignore a major story that was on the front page of the New York Times at a time when the network, among others, as you say, had devoted a lot of time to covering this story and to building up Clive Bundy, I think that gives him ammunition to Fox's detractors.
There are a lot of folks who sit in chairs just like ours who are giving Kurtz a whole lot of credit for going out there and saying that.
Well, I mean, I think he's stating the obvious, and I'm glad he did it on his show. I mean, there have been some questions before about whether he's, you know, withheld his punches on some things that Fox has done since he took his show over to Fox. But this time, I mean, it was so obvious. It was so patently obvious that Fox did not come to that story soon enough. I mean, they did do it later on their talk shows or whatever, but they didn't come to it soon enough, and he should call them out.
I think the whole issue here, I mean, it sort of goes back to the story we just got to talking about involving the Clippers, is that, you know, when the news media just pretty much opens up the mic or records what's going on and presents it out there to the public, they're pretty much doing their job, especially in instances like this, when you have people who basically make very ignorant statements such as Clive Bundy. It's just, you just got to, you know, let him do it. And for the network, Fox Network or any other network, not to acknowledge that as a problem and denounce that, I think that speaks volumes about where they stand in terms of where we are as a media in this country.
And, you know, anytime, whether it's conservative or liberal media, takes somebody and builds them up, you know, as this hero figure around whatever ideological point they're trying to make about a story, they're likely to fall into this trap because people have flaws and some people have really big, unforgivable flaws. And you build them up, it's going to take you down.
And I also think that what we really need to do in the media, is, especially those of us who engage in punditry, is to do a little bit of investigation on the people in which we're going to support. Because he's had a history of doing this. I mean, those who have heard these statements then went back and started doing some homework on it, found out that, wait a minute, he said these kinds of things before. This isn't anything new. So when pundits jump on bandwagons, mm-hmm. they need to do some homework before they endorse someone as a potential spokesman.
I do have one question about this story that I would love to see answered at some point. Don't know if it ever will be. According to Adam Negurny, who wrote this piece in the New York Times, the first story about it, the remarks came out at what was supposed to be a news conference, one of many that Bundy has been holding. Only one reporter and one photographer, he says in his story, showed up. Does that mean that reporter was him? Or if the tape came to the Washington Post, did the Washington Post have the only reporter there who decided they weren't going to break the story? and the New York Times was instead. It's a little bit fuzzy, but if only one reporter was there, somehow it was either the Times reporter who was there and didn't acknowledge that, or they got it through some other intermediary. And it was almost like Nagorny wasn't quite sure what to do with it when he first got the tape, because he buried, I mean, in the lead paragraph, there was a little mention of talking about race, but he buried that story well down in a lengthy piece about what Bundy was talking about.
And I think the larger issue here is when you're talking about, you know, at least Bundy's talking about government subsidies and that sort of thing. I'm looking at this and going like, well, wait a minute, you're using government land for your cattle herd. And you're basically saying that the government shouldn't have any say in that. Last time I checked, that's a government subsidy as well. So to say that, you know, African-Americans or some African-Americans mm-hmm. or some poor people are living on government subsidies and you're not, that's sort of, you know, I don't know.
It just doesn't work out very well.
And he's just a poor case study for an issue that is a significant real issue out west.
So Sunday, while Howard Kurtz was calling out his network for its shameful coverage of the Bundy story, over on CNN, Brian Stelter was, well, in my opinion, missing out on a huge opportunity to talk about a pretty embarrassing story centering on his network. A Chicago Tribune investigation published very late Thursday night revealed Mayor Rahm Emanuel's office had influence and input on the storylines running through the CNN documentary series Chicagoland. The Tribune obtained more than 700 emails through a Freedom of Information Act request. In them, promises from the producers to show the mayor as, quote, the star that he really is, requests that he set up appearances at Fanger High School or have more phone conversations while being driven around in his SUV, something that viewers see happen at least once per episode. The mayor's office denies working with the producers or granting them any special access above and beyond any other media outlet. Here's the Tribune's Bill Ruthart. He reported the story.
Mayor's office did not want to answer any specific questions regarding how the series was filmed, how certain scenes came to be. They issued a blanket statement pointing out that the access that was given to CNN and the things that they did for CNN or things they do for any reporter, including the Tribune. I would note that most of the local media don't get the kind of access that CNN had for 9 months.
A CNN spokeswoman told the Huffington Post that the mayor's office was never given any editorial control or approval for anything in the show or its promotional materials. Mark Levin, one of the producers in the series, said in an interview that he was coordinating and that that's what producers do. Where is the line between coordinating and staging?
Well, I think whenever you have a politician involved, there's going to be some staging. They're going to try to put him or her in the most positive light. And I think that this whole Chicagoland thing was a part of that. For them not to have some sort of coordination, that's unfathomable. There had to be something. And for these emails to go back and forth, that it just doesn't seem to be unusual, at least in the way that I look at it. But I think that what is the problem for CNN is the fact that they've basically promoted this as being unfettered access and a look behind the scenes, when in fact, you know, it was some staging going on there.
I watched a couple of installments mm-hmm. of it, and my impression from, you know, those two was that this really was kind of PR for Emanuel and the city. Now, I don't blame the mayor. I mean, politicians, that's their job.
If they're going to offer it to you, take it.
And they're going to take it, you know. Yeah. And I hear CNN saying, well, the whole series, we showed the warts and the problems and murders and all this kind of stuff. But really, I mean, this is kind of like, again, going back to our first story, when the president is saying, when ignorant people say stuff, you know, just let them say it. Read those emails. And that pretty much tells you the level of collaboration that was going on between CNN, the producers for CNN, and the mayor's office.
Well, and anybody who's watching or listening to this program can read them. They are available. The Tribune put them up on Document Cloud, and we have links available on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. It just so happened I was coincidentally in Chicago when this story broke, traveling with some of our students and touring that newsroom. And I spoke with Bill Ruthart about it. And he has also mentioned on radio in Chicago, on WGN Radio Sunday morning, that there are also requests out to the Chicago Public Schools and to the Chicago Police Department to see what levels of coordination may have gone on there.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure there's going to be some coordination there because, I mean, these are public entities mm-hmm. and they're going to want to demonstrate to the public that they're doing the job that they're being hired to do, and in case of politicians, being voted in to do. So there's going to be some staging there. It's just a question of what level was it at, and was it done in a way to sort of manipulate the way in which the government operates on a daily basis.
Well, I mean, and it was clear from those emails, even if CNN, the producers, didn't get everything they wanted, I mean, they were talking about how to set up particular shots, how to stage certain scenes. I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Let's drive around more.
And, you know, okay, some of this is going to happen. I mean, let's not pretend it doesn't. But what really bothers me about this, I applaud CNN for trying to do things like running more documentaries and more series and other shows. It's not just kind of the news of the day. But this really raises some serious concerns. Remember, it wasn't that many months ago when CNN was planning to do a documentary about Hillary Clinton, and a lot of people were up in arms about that. Well, maybe people should be up in arms if that's the kind of thing you'll do to get access to important people.
And here's the thing. If you're going to do those types of things, you need to be transparent about it. And I think part of the problem, like I said earlier, with what CNN is doing is that they're saying that that it's one way when in fact it's another. And that's just what one of the things that gets them in trouble.
So speaking of that transparency, the last thing we were talking about was Howard Kurtz calling out his network for not covering something properly. Should we have expected to have seen this on Reliable Sources on Sunday morning?
I think we should have seen it on Reliable Sources, but I also think that CNN has a responsibility to let the public know that this is the access we had. Here's how it's being put together. They can do that either in the program or they can do it on the website. There's so many ways in which you can be transparent.
And there's a bit of a double standard now when it comes to Reliable Sources, because when he was writing about, when he was at the New York Times and their media critic, he was writing about Howard Kurtz and how sometimes he wasn't covering the whole story. And I don't think there's really a good excuse for them not doing this one.
Well, the excuse, I've actually had a quick email conversation with Brian Stelter about this, and the answer he gave me was, we recorded the show on Friday. Well, the Chicago Tribune's building, the CNN Bureau, is a couple of floors above the Chicago Tribune's newsroom, and we've even run into situations here when a story breaks, even though we do record our program before it airs at 6:30, we find a way to work that in too.
Right.
So we'll see what happens, and maybe it'll show up this Sunday. When I first read about this next story that we're going to be talking about, I had to do a double take. It's just one of those crazy, convoluted tales that twist and turn when journalists decide to go undercover. Two reporters from Britain's Sunday Times wanted to see what would happen if they tried to buy a baby in Bulgaria. Reporters at a Bulgarian television station spotted their advertisement and, not realizing who placed it, decided to set a trap. The goal? To do a story on foreigners who come looking to buy Bulgarian babies. The two teams of reporters exchanged emails, negotiating the sale of the child, until they each realized the whole thing was a ruse put on by the other side. Part of this, when I first read it, I really wanted to laugh. And then I realized there is nothing at all funny about this story. I mean, first you have the issue of buying and selling children, but the second part of it was there wasn't even an issue or a child up for sale. This was journalists creating a situation.
This is akin to the KSDK folks in St. Louis going into the school in Kirkwood and causing such a stir by pretending to be maybe somebody who might cause problems there. This is not the kind of staging you should do to get a story.
I mean, that's exactly what I thought about when I read this, was the KSDK story. But to me, it goes back to, though, you can tell the story without resorting to gimmicks. And when journalists try to sort of create these images to get the public to see, here's the problem that's going on, instead of just going out and looking at the problem and doing the hard leg reporting, you run into problems like this.
Last week, the New York Police Department learned the hard way that sometimes asking people to tweet and send in pictures can sometimes blow up in your face. And right as that was happening, the Indianapolis Star was gearing up its own social media campaign in advance of the National Rifle Association's convention meeting in that city over the weekend. The Star asked readers to tweet pictures using the hashtag #ShowUsYourGuns. The move was controversial with readers who didn't appreciate the timing, publishing along with it a report on the city's 50th homicide. Editors say the move wasn't meant to be insensitive. What it was hoping to do was capitalize on the 70,000 people who were going to be coming to town and interested in the NRA show and engage with them. didn't work out so well.
Well, it's one of the things I tell my students all the time. It's not what you meant to do. It's what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those instances where what you did not work out very well at all. There should have been some sort of conversation as to what do we expect when we put this out and what could possibly happen. And I don't think that conversation took place. If it did, they definitely didn't talk long enough because it turned out to be a fiasco.
It was a clever hashtag, but a little too clever. And you saw some people, I don't know if they were regular Star readers or just protesters coming in, but a lot of folks were posting pictures of school shooters, you know, just to call out or make the point about how insensitive this whole thing
kind
was.
Kind of how distasteful it was.
The problem I have is whenever you have the NRA coming to town, they're having their big convention. I think if you're going to cover that, just cover the convention. Don't try to do anything special. I mean, whether it's the NRA or whether it's the National Education Association, if it's a group that has a political agenda or have shown to have a political agenda, the best thing to do is just cover the convention and let the public decide how they want to interpret it.
Okay, I couldn't tell if Mike was about to say something on that or not. So before we go today, I want to talk about something that's a little bit fun. It's a photo that's been making its way around the interwebs the last few days. A memo sent out 20 years ago this week announcing the arrival of the internet at NPR. Dennis Fuse introduces employees to a collection of computer networks that is connected around the world. A code of netiquette exists among users within user groups, but otherwise you pay your money, find your niche, and take your chances. If you haven't seen this yet, I urge you to stop by the Lynx blog and take a look. How far we have come since 1994.
You know, I was here 20-some years ago, and I probably wrote a memo something like this to the faculty when we started teaching. Wow, this great new thing called the internet. And this was before there was a World Wide Web. The line I really liked was, the most powerful tool on the internet is email. You know, in some ways, maybe it still is today, but you know, look how far NPR has come from, you know, the wide-eyed, you know, wow, this internet thing too. They are one of the most sophisticated users of the internet and social media and mobile media to keep public media relevant.
I mean, I think it's fascinating when you sort of look at these memos and you think about the fact that now you have, you know, you have Twitter, you have, I mean, there's more communication going on by email as well as by text, I mean, even more by text, than you do actual people talking one-on-one. So, I mean, to come from where we were 20 years ago to now, it's incredible.
But it also says a little something about just how little time has actually passed. And when we think about huge revolutions in communication, here's one that occurred 20 years ago. So for us to still be in all the churn and not knowing where it's all going is actually pretty natural. 20 years ago is not that long.
Well, and think about how much we're even benefiting from that. As an NPR member station here at KBIA, some of our listeners are listening on 91.3, but a good number of our listeners could be listening to us online from the website. They could be listening to us from the iTunes podcast. They could be watching us on YouTube or on television.
And frankly, I think going forward, most folks who are listening to folks like us are kind of our age. Younger people are not really consuming public media, or at least they're not consuming it through radio stations and TV stations. So NPR and PBS and all these other folks need to figure out ways to use the interwebs, mobile technology, and other things to try to reach that audience, or their business model is going to be in trouble too.
Yeah, I mean, but if you think about it, you go from that time period where the computer was stationary to now where, you know, you have pretty much, you have the smartphone or you have a tablet.
I was going to say, you put one in your pocket right before we started today.
Minutes ago. Exactly. I mean, that's the incredible part to me is that it's not just the software that has changed and the way in which we talk to each other. It's also the hardware and how that's sort of come about in terms of a hardwired on a desk computer to walking around with pretty much a little computer on your hand.
Well, that music means that we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about all the topics we talked about today. Check out our Lynx blog. Find it under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.